touching the ground, I connect with all of life. Touching my heart, I awaken compassion for all life. You are listening to Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey, a podcast about life, the variety of lived spiritualities of the people around us, and how we are much more alike than different. I am your host, Brother Pax. Who is God? Have you ever wondered who God is and what he or she or they are like? What do they want, if anything? I've asked those questions and have spent most of my life exploring the various religious and spiritual expressions that provide answers or a claim to those questions. But my first religion was a fundamentalist Christianity, the first one that I embraced as a teenager. And it could be hard to break from those religions in which we were raised, or like in my case, a religion I had a full conversion to. People spend years deconstructing from their former belief systems. My guest today is Heather Hamilton. The collision of certain truths with her religious worldview led Heather on a search for clarity and understanding. Heather is the author of Returning to Eden, a book that describes her journey away from evangelical fundamentalist Christianity. But rather than giving up Jesus in the Bible to the fundamentalist, she reads it as myth and mystery. And I have to confess, this has been the best book I have read in years. This book shook me to the core. Since leaving fundamentalism so many years ago, anytime I opened a Bible and tried to read it for any length of time, I would experience anxiety, almost a panic attack, a trauma reaction. And I will say Heather's book provided me a new perspective, an approach to the Bible as a non-dual mystical text when read non-literally and mystically. So this book, Returning to Eden, is a book for mystics, agnostics, people of any faith tradition who long to go deeper into themselves in relation to others and those on the planet. So a little bit more about Heather. Heather Hamilton is a best-selling author of Returning to Eden, A Field Guide for the Spiritual Journey. That's the full name of the book. She received her bachelor's in journalism from Georgia State University. And after filming and editing stories of people from all over the world, celebrities, orphans, religious leaders, royal family members, political figures, and everyday people, Heather has recognized the common threads and themes intertwining all humans across religions, cultures, classes, and demographics. She's passionate about fostering human connection through storytelling, writing, art, and exchanging ideas. She writes a monthly newsletter called Unorthodox at returningtoeden.com. Heather, thank you so much for being on here tonight.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to talk to you.
So before we dive into your book, if you would, tell us a little bit about your story growing up. Were you raised religious? For those
yes.
Who haven't
heard it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was, well, okay. I was in the evangelical church, started out Southern Baptist from about age 7. My introduction was through Awana's, which if any of your listeners don't know what that is, it's like, you know, a little evening thing that kids would come to, you know, you memorize Bible verses and get awards. It's on, I don't know, I felt like it was like girl and boy scouts for church kind of thing.
Right.
But so that was kind of my introduction, where I would go with a friend to Awana's, and then started going to Sunday school. And then it was actually through me and my sister, like, going regularly to the kids programs, that my parents started coming more regularly as well. So so I did grow up in the church, but I mean, I don't know how common this story is. I didn't feel like it was forced on me. It felt like something that I really enjoyed, that I wanted to be at. We moved states a few times when I was growing up, and you know, every time we moved, I just went and found my new youth group or whatever. So it was kind of on my own initiative. I did feel like very saturated in the culture, which obviously have detangled some of that now, but I didn't feel like it was something that was thrust upon me that I didn't have a choice in.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So in looking at your book, who has been the audience of your book, and did any of that audience surprise you?
Oh, that's a good question. So who has been the audience for the book? It's been a really wide audience of people. I feel like there have been, you know, it's written from my perspective, as I think it would be fair to call me like a deconstructed Christian. You know, I think it's hard to pinpoint down a specific label for me right now, even with myself. I'm like, oh, what do I call myself? But when I was writing, I wanted to write with that honesty of my own journey, and not hold back about it. But also I felt like I had such a keen understanding of the evangelical mindset that, you know, it was kind of like, well, if a woman from my grandmother's Southern Baptist church picked up this book, I wanted to be able to get that person from A to Z. So it was actually a little complicated to write, because I wanted someone who was firmly in the evangelical space to be able to follow me. And I also knew that there would be people who had already left, already deconstructed, and had left a lot of this behind, that would be reading. So yeah, I've had evangelicals read, I've had ex-evangelicals read, atheists, people who consider themselves just spiritual, people who are more like in the contemplative, mystical wisdom traditions. And I've heard quite a few people who were like, I didn't realize that this perspective was in the Bible, and it's re-intrigued me after many years being away.
It's definitely blown my mind as a, you know, reading it, and like you, I became a Southern Baptist, a Christian at 16. Mm-hmm. Hardcore, by choice, was not raised religious, and only saw one way, only knew of one way of reading the Bible, and it was very, very literal in many, mm-hmm. many cases. And with that, it brought up a lot of fears. And so with this, I'm going to ask a question. Did you ever have any of those fears and you talk about this a touch in your book, your friends were going to hell, so you had mm-hmm. to evangelize constantly. But also, did you have any of those where, I walk over to my friend's house, who I knew their family's all Christian, and they weren't there. Maybe the rapture happened and I missed it. Do you ever have any of those?
That's really interesting. I definitely did believe in the rapture as a literal event that was going to happen. What's interesting is I can recall many times, I don't know, you know, a date or something would come up on the calendar, like the year 2000 or something like this, mm-hmm. you know, this is when it's going to happen. And there'd be all these predictions about it. And I can't even remember what verse this is or whatever. I just remember kind of thinking, reading, you know, it's going to come like a thief in the night, you know, mm-hmm. like no one's going to know when it's going to happen. And so I was just like, why would we spend any time thinking about it? Because no, it already said that no one's going to know. So I don't think I really had a lot of anxiety about that specifically. I did about hell, but the rapture stuff, I think I just was like, what's the point in even thinking much about it? Because it is going to be this unpredictable thing. So I did, I mean, I have a lot of friends who did have anxiety about that. I mentioned one of them who, you know, in the year 2000 was like hiding in his closet in the youth room or something like this, because their church thought that this was it, you know, Armageddon. So yeah, but I personally didn't have a ton of anxiety about that. More, mine was more about hell and if my personal salvation was secure, and I had a lot of OCD and anxiety about that. So yeah, as a child, for me, I was, you know, quote, saved when I was seven, and I can just remember countless of nights laying there like, I'm gonna say the prayer one more time, you know, just in case I go in my sleep and I haven't locked it in, you know, I really want God to know that I'm really sincere, so I'm gonna say it again. So it was a lot of that in the beginning, you know, quietly just laying in my bed doing the sinner's prayer. And then once I got older, I think it turned into a, like, proving myself to God, proving how seriously I took everything. And I don't know, it turned into sort of a masochistic compulsion to, like, I always had to be like the hardest thing, you know, like I couldn't just play on the playground. I had to witness to my friends, you know. Yeah. And whenever some sort of, like, you know, challenge or idea like that would pop into my head, it was like, oh, you know, I really don't want to do it. I guess I have to do it, kind of thing. So I don't know. I feel like it ended up a little bit masochistic in that way, where, yeah, I probably annoyed a lot of people.
It's funny you say that. Just recently, I reconnected with a friend from high school on social media. And she said, I remember you in high school. We used to turn and go the other way because we knew you were going to witness to us every time. Same thing. I think I was, for me, it was trying to hide, you know, I had to overachieve.
Yeah.
I got happy because there was a part of me that just absolutely despised who I was.
Yeah. And
you have to somehow... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's ultimately what probably led me into, like, the mega church environment, because mm-hmm. that was sort of a way to do the witnessing, but it was quote unquote cool, you know, like it wasn't so brash and in your face, you know, like, have you accepted Jesus? You know, are you going to whatever? It was, oh, we can just create these really cool and catchy and relevant services and put all of our energy in towards, like, creating something very compelling, and then, like, let God do the rest, or let the charismatic preacher do the rest.
Right.
So I think that I haven't quite made that connection until just now, but I do think that that was probably some being in that environment and why I was attracted to it. It was innovative and all of that, but it kind of took the edge off the awkwardness right. of witnessing.
So, and your husband worked in a mega church. Did you work there too? Did you work?
Mm-hmm. I did. A lot of contract work. So both of us have been contractors, but at the time where, like, my experiences in the book, he was on staff as the music director at a large mega church. So we were extremely saturated in this world. You know, it was a lot of our income and a lot of our relationships and just the whole culture and ecosystem that we were in was, you know, bound up in this mega church environment.
And then something changed, a shift happened
mm-hmm.
that changed everything.
What
happened?
Well, long story short, I had some major revelations about my life. It was almost over the course of a few days, or really instantaneously, and then the process, like, progressed over the course of a few days. But it was like a 30,000 foot view of my life, where I saw all my trauma, all my coping mechanisms. I was able to see it objectively. And, you know, the closest you can get to describing these kind of things are just like metaphors, but I feel like I just woke up to my life. It was like this spiritual amnesia where suddenly I was like waking up from a dream. And it was so jarring to me that it just sent me spiraling into like an identity crisis and a nervous breakdown, for lack of a better term. So yeah, that continued over the course of 4 or 5 days, and it was just spiraling into this like psychological descent, which finally culminated in this psychological place that I recognized as hell. It was this moment of, you know, me crying out to God, my God concept at that time, and just knowing that there was nobody on the end of the line. Like, my whole concept of God fell apart. It was very much like a, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me kind of moment. And I just recognized that the whole construct of God that I had lived my whole life believing didn't exist. And yeah, so it just really felt like the end of the road for me, like in terms of what do I do or where do I go from here? And so that moment, I recognized it as hell. Like, it felt like absolute like fire and alienation to my soul, and just like a rock bottom nothingness. And so shortly after that, within a few, this was in the middle of the night, and so early the next morning, I let my husband know what was going on. And this was so jarring for me that it put me in a place where I recognized, if I don't get help, this is probably not going to end well. There was just such overwhelm in my system that I was like, I think that this would lead to suicide if I didn't get some kind of professional intervention here. So we called 911, and when I opened the door, there was a transgender woman who was part of the EMS team standing on my front porch. And it was just the most unexpected thing for me at that time, because my orientation towards, you know, anyone outside of Christianity, or even anyone within Christianity, but that I deemed as like a sinner, or, you know, who had strayed from God or whatever, it was me as the Christian leader bestowing my truth or the truth to you, trying to help you. And all now of a
the
sudden,
roles were reversed.
Yeah. Yes, the roles were reversed. And I noticed this, and I noticed my reluctance to receive help. You know, can I trust this person? I had never been in a position where I was really that vulnerable, and I had to trust someone, you know, that I didn't know and that I had preconceived notions about. And, you know, there was really no other choice in the moment. So I just start word vomiting my situation, which was, you know, very personal details about my life that I recognized were fueling this panic. And as soon as she started speaking back to me, it was like the essence of what I would call Christ, my name for it, like started coming off of her. And it was like, I don't know how else to say it, but it was like Jesus in a transgender body on my front porch, which was just the peak of irony, you know, because I'm like, I've spent my whole life out at these churches, you know, trying to find God and meet God there and bring people into the church to find God. And now I have Jesus standing on my front porch. It was like this picture of like, oh, I've been overlooking it the whole time. It's been right here, like on my front doorstep, so to speak. But anyway, so I have this, what I later came to recognize as like a mystical encounter with this woman, where I recognized Christ in her. And at the same time, I recognized Christ in me. It was like the divine spark or the essence of both of us was the same, and it was fundamentally loving. Mm-hmm. I recognized my true, I call it my true self in the book, but you could say, like, you know, my essence, who I really was this fundamental love. And I saw that in her. And then pretty soon I saw it in everybody. You know, despite the fact that we all have to go through our own processes to recognize that in ourselves and recognize it in others. But it was just, it was a sudden and complete shift in the way that I saw the world and the way that I saw everybody. And, you know, part of how I moved forward and my recovery and all of this was recognizing what were essentially trauma responses to to losing touch with that knowledge about myself and about others and, you know, my relationship to the divine and nature. You know, the trauma of being asleep to that and then other traumas in my life and kind of being able to recognize my behavior or my spiritual amnesia as this giant coping mechanism. So, of course, it led me to see pretty much everybody else through that same lens and just kind of develop this heart of compassion for sort of the human situation.
Right.
'Cause I think that we all actually go through something similar in our process of human development.
So I love it. You know, first off, I'm automatically, I think of Ram Dass. Are you familiar mm-hmm. with him? You know,
oh yeah.
You know, treat everyone that you meet as if they're God and drag.
Yeah.
And in some sense, Jesus Christ came to you as a transsexual woman.
Yes.
What a powerful
That's exactly message. What it was.
And again, I think of all the saints and mystics that talk about God as a mother,
mm-hmm.
and you know, in that way, coming and caring and meeting you. And one of the neat things I love about your book is that you take the Bible stories, and so even as you're telling the story, I'm thinking about scales falling off your eyes,
mm-hmm.
Awakening, the angel coming saying, "Be not afraid." All these mm-hmm. different stories come alive, not in a literal sense, but in a spiritual or mythical sense.
Yes.
Powerful and life-changing. Just blew me out of the water. So I guess now I ask, who is God for you now?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, yeah, I'm kind of just going to riff on this one.
Sure.
Because it's a complicated answer. I think I struggle with the word who. I had to take a while to even, like, I stopped using the word God because mm-hmm. there was so much projection onto that word as God as a person or someone that I would, like, a specific someone that I would go give a hug to when I died. Like, it was like that concrete, you know? And so when my God concept died, I had to kind of abandon the word for a little bit and try to use other phrases to describe, like, the essence of what I felt it was. I think I used Divine Mother for a while,
mm-hmm.
although, it's beyond gender, but at that time it was like, I was experiencing this love in a very maternal way. So that was one that I liked for a while, but ultimately I came to my concept of God now is pretty close to ultimate reality. It's the same thing. I'm more comfortable with the word now just because through, like, spiritual practice and retraining my brain, I don't think of God as a who, but it's I think of God as, like, the energy of everything. I mean, I feel like this gets, like, a little woo-woo here, but reality itself is God, and this recognition that it is fundamentally loving. Not that every experience that I have in life is pleasant or feels like a loving experience or whatever, but it's like this generative animating life force that is animating everything, like in Ephesians, where it says, you know, Christ fills everything in every way. That to me is very literal now. It's like the energy that's manifesting all things. Mm-hmm. So it's that, and then it's also whatever is beyond that, you know, through like contemplative practices or whatnot. You know, when you go to a point where you've stilled your mind and the thoughts are no more and you're just being, and you kind of reach the edge of, you know, whatever that is. Yeah, whatever is beyond that, you know, generating this whole reality experience, that would be my concept. So I feel like that is a really fluffy, non-specific answer, but.
You know, but there's obviously, so a little more on my journey when I was kicked out, and mm-hmm. Long story short, I actually became a Hindu monk for 3 years. Mm-hmm. With that, obviously they describe the divine as supreme reality, mm-hmm. because ultimately any words we use are inadequate. I'm sure it sounds like that's kind of what you're expressing.
Yes. And which it also is why it's so hard to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's like, how do you describe it? And you're right, because then you're like, all right, sometimes we need that. It's personal. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's like, yeah, it's not just he. It's not just God. It's mm-hmm. especially, there's a lot of baggage with that. Made me think too, Carmen Acevedo Butcher recently retranslated Practicing the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection, but uses they, them pronouns mm-hmm. for God. I love mm-hmm. it, because mm-hmm. it gives a whole different perspective when they're talking about unity and oneness and all that.
Yeah.
So now with that, I'm sorry to ask these heavy questions here. Who is Jesus then?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually, I'm not plugging this podcast. I happen to hear a podcast, which I'm a fan of, Rainn Wilson. Do you know him, Dwight from The Office?
Yes. I haven't listened to it yet. It started showing up on my feed, but yes.
Yeah, well, he just put out a book called Soul Boom, I think it's called. And I haven't read it, but a podcast popped up with him and Russell Moore, who's the editor of Christianity Today, comes from like the Southern Baptist world. And I was just fascinated to listen to it because Rainn Wilson is Baha'i, and you know, he wrote this book on spirituality, and he's on this, you know, kind of Southern Baptist guy's podcast. So I was just fascinated to hear it. And they go through this whole conversation, which I felt like was wonderful, and like a hat tip to Russell Moore, because I don't think a lot of evangelical Christians would actually have a discussion with someone like Rainn, right, you know, about spiritual topics or whatever. But it did get to the end of the podcast, and you know, I was kind of just laughing because I was like, oh man. Russell goes, Rainn, now, like, I have to ask you, what would it take for you to convert to Christianity? You know, and I was just like, oh man, here comes the, you know, the sales pitch or whatever.
Yeah. 4 points in a prayer.
Yes. And Rainn answered it in a genius way. He said, you know, Russell, what would it take for you to become a Baha'i? And ultimately, Russell Moore said, I think that I would have to believe that Jesus was the lampshade and not the lamp, or the light, excuse mm-hmm. me, the lampshade and not the light. And I felt like that was a really, really great picture of this distinction between Jesus and Christ. And Richard Rohr explains this wonderfully in his book, The Universal Christ, where essentially Christ, I would call Christ the light, and I would call Jesus a lampshade that is illuminating this light with great transparency. So it's sort of like this creative tension to hold, where I think a metaphor that I give in my book is like if you have air and you blow up a balloon mm-hmm. with air, and that's more of an unsanctimonious metaphor, but that I would say that the air inside the balloon is Christ, and then what is giving it form is Jesus. So you know, when we talk about a balloon, I'm talking about the air inside of it and, you know, the form that's capturing it. But even when the form goes away, the air still remains. Christ still remains. So I, with Jesus, it's, you know, I think of him as a 33-year-old historical figure that, you know, in bodily form was here for that amount of time. And him illuminating the characteristics of Christ, which is, you know, I would describe Christ as kind of how we were talking about God, like this animating force, this loving energy that's animating everything. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's tricky because to kind of describe it like that almost feels like I'm devaluing Jesus, and I don't see it that way. No. I see it more as like elevating everything to be able to love everything in the way that I love Jesus. It's like, you know, I had this special love reserved for Jesus for, you know, the first half of my life. And now the practice is like, oh, how do I love everything like that? You know?
The everything and everyone becomes Jesus.
Yes, exactly.
In that sense. And what you're truly loving then is the Christ.
Yes.
Which existed prior to this physical person named Jesus being born.
Yes.
It's very similar, not exactly, but you know, in Hinduism, they talk about Brahman, which is all, everything. And, but Brahman might take a form like Krishna for a time and be utterly, completely full. But while Krishna's talking, like for in the Bhagavad Gita and Arjuna, you also are the divine. And so it's kind of helping people wake up to that. It's not so much all about me, you know, Jesus saying it's about me. It's to realize when, you know, the when they're going to cast stones at the woman, is there's Jesus. There's the divine. There's the holy presence. See it, and when you learn to see it, it changes who you are and it changes how you see. So how would you describe, and this is the part of the book that I just absolutely love, how would you describe how you read and explore the Bible now, and how is that differing from, say, how a fundamentalist might read that, or how you used to read that?
Well, during the mystical experience that I was sharing about, this experience of essentially recognizing Christ wake up in me, or the awareness of it. I woke up to the awareness of it. The whole experience, so when I was in the psychological place of hell, I also recognized it as the belly of the whale. I just knew sort of in that moment, not that I was like doing a whole exegesis at that time, you know, I was like trying to get into therapy and all this stuff, but I just knew that that is where, that that's what the Jonah and the whale story was about. That was kind of the first illumination that came to me, where I was very quickly just like, that didn't really happen. Like, that's not a literal story, but this is such a poignant metaphor for what was happening. And I knew that that's where I was. I knew that I was in the belly. You know, and we in church, we talk about rebirth all the time. And there's the story in the New Testament where Nicodemus goes to Jesus. He's like, you know, what do I need to do? And Jesus is telling him to be reborn. And he's like, what are you talking about? You know, going back into my mother's womb, like, I don't understand this. So part of my spiritual transformation was essentially going back to the beginning before I was born. And I had actually, in this week where I was having the nervous breakdown, I had a vision of myself like in a womb as a baby. And it was this very isolating experience, which I felt very grieved about at the time because I felt so alone. But I recognized the whole thing as this rebirth experience. Like, you have to go back to the beginning recapture the essence of who you are, strip away all these identities that you've attached to yourself. You know, I'm a mom, I'm a video producer, I'm a Christian. It was, we're going back all the way before then to discover the face I had before I was born. And acquainting myself with who, what that was, my authentic essence, and then working to live out of that place and bring that essence into the world and let it animate my life. And so it was, at first, it was a very basic, like, relearning, like, what do I like, you know, what do I like in life? What did I, you know, it was very difficult to even, like, make spontaneous decisions, because I felt like everything about my life was so programmed with this super ego of what I was supposed to be doing, you know?
Right.
So I recognize the story as this re-entering into a psychological belly, you know, back into the womb, where the old personality is broken down and metabolized into this new energy. And so I very much felt like this new person, like I was feeling my life energy for the first time. And so, you know, then we see in the story about how Jonah is birthed, or is spit back out onto the ordinary land. It's this rebirthing out of the belly, where you go and then you take this recovered essence into the world. So it's this idea of recovering who you truly are, and then bringing that into the world, which is, you know, withering, or which has forgotten itself, forgotten, you know, the truth of this ultimate reality and the way things are. And so, yeah, that was kind of the first story where the light bulbs went off, where I wasn't calling it myth at that point. There was, like, a lot more reading and research and educating I was doing. I came across Joseph Campbell, which I'm sure you're familiar with him, but if your readers aren't, you know, he was a professor of comparative mythology, and he really, like, brought the power of myth back onto the scene in pop culture, like in the 80s. So Star Wars is, you know, very much influenced by the hero's journey and Joseph Campbell and all this. But yeah, so I started seeing all these fantastical stories in the Bible as symbolic maps for this inner journey, and all this different symbolism. So it was, you know, it was mythology, and it was also examining my own psychology and symbols and, you know, things like that were coming up for me. Getting into Carl Jung and his, you know, interpretation of symbols and, you know, things that show up in dreams and all of this. And, you know, each one of us kind of has our own personal consciousness. And then there are also symbols in the collective unconscious, but really paying attention to the symbols and the parts in the stories that I really resonated with, and kind of integrating that into my healing and figuring out where to go from here. So there were certain stories, certain myths or whatever, that I felt like could really read me, could help me locate where I was, and kind of gave me the courage to know what to do next, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. One of the stories you tell in your book that just blew me away, you talk about the story of Abraham sacrificing of Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know, you know, there's in the Bible, God asked Abraham to take his son Isaac up on the mountain to sacrifice him. And you kind of talk about the God in the story may not be Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk a little bit about that, just to kind of give people a taste of what's in the book?
Yeah. So, you know, growing up, much like you, we kind of are left with two different pictures of what God is. And somehow there's this extreme cognitive dissonance that I don't know why. I never really wrestled with it or saw the obvious contradiction or whatnot, you know, but we're told Jesus is God, you know, Jesus is saying, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Like, if you want to know what God is like, look at me. That's it. You know, so in Jesus, we see this nonviolent, this loving, compassionate person who, you know, literally forgives his murderers while they're murdering him, you know? And it's not like this sentimental thing. It's him forgiving with his whole, like, just refusing to hold on to any kind of cynicism or
resentment. He sees the Christ in them.
Yes,
even
exactly.
As he's dying by them. Yeah.
Yes. And by doing that, he frees himself, you know? We see him in another form where he's this expansive spirit, you know, that can walk through walls and, you know, is kind of just one with everything and can show up in some kind of form and then evaporate into, you know, the wind or whatever. And, you know, it's symbolic of this like expansion of, I'm not holding on to anything. I'm so free in light that I can just slip through wherever, slip through life. However, there's nothing that is weighing on me, nothing that I'm attaching myself to. And then you have Jesus's angry dad, essentially, you know, from the Old Testament, where it's like, you know, I gotta test Abraham in this story. I gotta test Abraham to see how much he loves me and how much I can really count on him. So I'm gonna tell him to go not just kill his son, like slaughter him, you know? It's very violent. So, you know, we end up with this tension between Jesus and Jesus's angry dad. And, you know, I kind of always felt like I was cool with Jesus, you know, but I was like, you know, ducking.
Sure.
Yeah. Trying to appease this angry man. And so, yeah, my personal experience with the Christ and my revelation of it was, yeah, some of these pictures of God in the Old Testament, like, this can't be it, you know, this can't be it. And so I started to notice that the revelation that I was having, where my whole God concept dies, is the same thing that's happening for all these ancient characters. You know, I thought that this is what God wanted from me. I thought that God was this violent, angry tyrant. And in this moment where, you know, quote unquote, God has my complete attention, there's a, you know, there's a waking up, like a jolt in that, oh, how I thought this was supposed to play out, it's the exact opposite. So, yeah, in the story of Abraham and Isaac, you know, it was very much a sacrificial system. You know, you sacrifice a pure animal to appease God, and it has to be a blood sacrifice, and the blood has to be pure and all this. And in the story, we see Abraham actually, you know, Abraham acting out the whole ritual. And before he takes Isaac up to the altar, says to his servants, like, wait here with the donkeys and we'll be back. He says that before they even go up, you know? So he's,
we'll be back.
We'll be back. Yeah. Like, what you think is going to happen isn't going to happen. But anyway, he has to go through the whole rigmarole so that we can have this revelation of, oh, we thought we had all the answers and we were totally wrong. And so, yeah, so my theory that I put forth is that the Bible is more of the story of the evolution of human consciousness. You know, it's not this book saying, you know, and God was so angry and so he flooded the earth and, you know, murdered all the old people and the pregnant people and all the children and everyone, you know, on the planet. It's, oh, this is what we thought God was like. And somewhere in the story, is the essence of Christ, which little by little, you know, progresses until the full revelation of Jesus, where we go, oh, God is in humans. God's in me, you know? And so I can't hurt another human without hurting Jesus, you know? And that really changes it, because before then it was like, oh, you know, I should try to be kind and loving to people because that's what God would want me to do. But if I screw it up, you know, it's just a person. You know what I mean? Like, if I screw it up, it's not like I've literally caused harm to Jesus. And then once you start seeing Christ literally in everybody, it's like, you know, kind of what you were saying about the woman about to be stoned. It's like, oh, it feels different when you are about to stone Jesus, someone that I see as Jesus, you know? Then it's almost like an instinct, you know, an instinct that's difficult to control, to not intervene in a situation like that, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
And I think, you know, looking at people from other religions, a pagan might say, you know, we're trying to kill the presence of the goddess, of the divine, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever name you use, the holy, the sacred, again, that we stumble over that, it's there. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of reading the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, as it's almost like a progression of people's understanding of God.
Yeah.
Till it reaches this point of absolute beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's funny because sometimes I read Paul and I'm like, oh, we're digressing a little bit, or those mm-hmm. attributed to Paul. I'm like, oh, we forgot mm-hmm. some of this, but we can always go back to. It makes me think of Gandhi, a quote by Gandhi, and asking, you know, why he's not a Christian. And he says, you know, I love your Christ. I do not care for your Christians, for your Christians are too little like your Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I even after I had left Christianity, I always said, I love Jesus.
Yeah.
I have no problem with Jesus. It's all the rest of it.
Yeah.
If more people live like Jesus and actually to see Jesus in everyone, in the trans woman, in mm-hmm. the outcast, the broken, but also in our persecutors,
in our perpetrators.
People, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
To see them as sacred.
Yeah.
I respond differently.
Yeah. There's a quote in the book from Carol Houselander. She was a Catholic mystic. And I hope I'll get it right, but she says something along the lines of, like, reverence must be paid for sinners, because even if their souls seem to be dead, you know, Christ in the tomb is still potentially the risen Christ. And so, yeah, so the paradigm shifts to, you know, those who haven't come to this awareness, it's like Christ is still in the tomb, you know? And a lot of the unhealthy behaviors that we see, or the coping mechanisms, or the trauma responses, like, or as much psychological disfigurement that we see, you know, you understand that it's that's not the essence of the person that we're seeing. It's really the brain's way of trying to deal with, you know, trauma, abuse, just the difficulty of suffering just by being in the world, you know? So anyways, yeah, I love that reverence must be paid.
So you described the false self and the true self in the book.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? What is the difference between the two?
Yeah. So it was interesting because, you know, a lot of what I try to get the reader to in the book is letting go of this dualistic way of thinking, you know, labeling everything mm-hmm. good and bad, right and wrong or whatever, and being able to see your own psychological and spiritual development as this, you know, pattern of growth and growth trajectory. And some of what the Bible seems to be saying is that this falling asleep to what I call the true self or your authentic essence is inevitable. And we see that in the garden with, you know, kind of starting out with this utopia where to me that symbolizes, you know, how we come into the world as infants in this place of unitive consciousness, where there's no perception of separation from God or anyone. You know, an infant will quite literally perceive itself to be one with its mother. There's no like me and my mom. It's just existing. And then once the brain starts to develop, the rational mind, that's what begins to label and divide everything. So we see that with Adam's, you know, labeling of all the animals. Mm-hmm. And so it's categorizing everything, which is a fantastic function of the brain, but it puts us asleep to this connection with our souls, you know? And so that to me is really what the story of Adam and Eve symbolizes, is this split between the rational masculine mind, which is symbolized by Adam, and the creative feminine life force of the soul, which is symbolized by Eve. And so there's this split that happens, and you know, it says that Adam, or the mind, is cast out of the garden, and it actually doesn't say that Eve is cast out. So it's more like the mind is cast out of the realm of the soul, and that's really when our quote-unquote trouble begins. And so the mind, you know, the false self is really the equivalent of the ego. I just use the term true self and false self, but there's other terms for it. And what that is it's the brain's perception of itself, you know, and you go, right. Who am I? I don't know. I was in so many like church small groups, and like every time we started out, it's like, okay, introduce yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think like, go. All right, what's the sales pitch on myself? You know, who am I and what can I add to the list now or whatever? But it's, you know, not just your roles, but it's, you know, what do I need to do to be a good person? You know, if I want to be a good person, I need to act this way. And, you know, I don't need to cuss, and I need to adhere to the rules, and all of this. So the false self is your perception of yourself. And some people, you know, their ego isn't about, you know, being a good person at all. It's concerned with something else, you know, maybe it's I'm a defender of the group or whatever, you know, my preoccupation is with, you know, being on the defense and making sure that like I create a safe and secure place for myself. You know, different ego structures, different type structures have different preoccupations. But anyway, so I kind of paint the false self like that, and talk about the spiritual journey being about detaching from those conceptions that your brain has, and coming to recognize your true self, or your authentic essence, or your oneness with everything. And it's literally just your being, and recognizing it as an extension of being, or an extension of ultimate reality, you know? So when we think of, like, if you think of God as the sun, recognizing who you are as like a sun ray, you know, on your own, you're not the whole thing, but it is the whole thing that is filling and animating who you are. So, you know, God could not exist apart from everything.
God is the ocean, and we're a wave that comes up.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's funny. Are you familiar with the Gospel of Thomas?
Yeah, a little bit.
Oh my gosh.
I can't like quote it as much, but I love it, and I reference it a few times.
I spent several years just reading and meditating. In fact, I did a blog post on every saying and just a meditation on it. And then and one of the things I always thought, well, man, they should include the Bible, but you know, it just doesn't fit. Baloney. Just reading, I was like, this is the same message. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, when you come to realize the truth, you'll be troubled, and then you will be amazed. And then you, and he talks about going back to, basically talks about going back to the garden, to this oneness over and over. It's just going back a child of 7 days, because on the eighth day they were circumcised, I believe it's the eighth day. That is like going back even before the rules and the laws and all that came into and it just blows me away. And I was like, oh, this fits that. This fits that.
Yeah. But what's so crazy about it is that it was only after my experience of that could I see it. I quite literally just could not see it or read anything through that lens before having my own experience. So it's this interesting thing. You know, there's another metaphor that you could use, so many, but of a caterpillar becoming a butterfly, you know, and you have this existence of being a caterpillar where you perceive the world on one level and have your caterpillar experiences. And then suddenly, you know, you're swept up into this womb called a cocoon, and the old caterpillar quite literally melts. Like, quite a hellish experience, I would imagine, you know, but there's no resistance to it. But there's this melting and then this rebirth where now suddenly, you know, this entity, it's the same thing, is, you know, flapping around, having this butterfly experience. And it sort of felt like that, where I was just perceiving everything in this new way, but also quickly kind of realizing that unless you've been through an experience like that, it's just impossible to explain what it's like to flutter around in the clouds. You know, it's not better or worse or anything. It's just a different experience that happens at a different point in the progression of things, in the progression of nature, you know?
And it's like, you can't go back. Once that door is open, that was one thing. I remember at one point I was like, maybe I'll just go back. I'll say I'm sorry. And I'll go back to my fundamentalist mindset, my small world. It was so much more comfortable inside that cocoon or inside that life. Yeah. But you can't. Once, you know, light's turned on, you can't pretend like it never existed.
Yes. Yeah. You're cast out of a different kind of garden. You know, there's no going back to that garden of ignorance, or, you know, that certain paradigm. So, but I also felt that maybe this is a Richard Rohr quote. Well, I know what he talks about including and transcending, but, you know, what he kind of means is that when you really do include and transcend, you can stop like denigrating the places where you were before. Like, there were certain things that I gleaned, you know, from those environments. There were certain experiences that I had that were formative and, you know, that got me to where I am today. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, initially there's this anger, you know, about, you know, okay, this is wonderful, but now I'm like all by myself up here fluttering around where everyone I love is down there not understanding me. You know, it's frustrating. And so there's it's not an immediate thing. There's still this work to like work through our attachments and our expectations and, you know, kind of recognizing I might be expecting way too much from certain people who can't see it this way right now, you know? And so, you know, for some, I kind of, or maybe my initial reaction was to just like keep beating the drum, you know? To them, I probably sounded like a gong. And then kind of coming to this place of acceptance where it was like, you know, we're not there yet in this relationship, but it doesn't mean that I have to be judgmental. I understand that that is still what they need for now. And when they don't need it anymore, hopefully they'll come along, you know? And some of that, it's like kind of backing off of the judgment or trying to pull people along with me. Some of it where it was just like where I released the energy, I was sort of surprised to be like, oh, well, now, you know, now there's been a little bit of a shift where we can like at least live peaceably together, you know?
Mm-hmm. What does your spiritual practice look like now?
Oh, it's a good question. So I have 3 kids, ages almost 5 to 10. So what is so funny is when I first had this experience, my youngest had just been born. And so I would get up in the morning and I feel like I had so much time in the morning to meditate. You know, I could do it for like an hour or an hour and a half or whatever. And the baby would sleep and, you know, finally be like, I should probably go get the baby up kind of thing. And as she's gotten older, my time that I actually just have to myself has gotten smaller, where, you know, I put the older kids on the bus and sit down to, you know, do a meditation or whatever. And it's like, I swear, as soon as I like start my little timer or something, I hear the door open and my youngest daughter is, you know, coming down to hang out or whatever. But so my practice is meditation, and, you know, doing yoga when I can. But then also just trying to like be present to these little moments, you know, especially with my kids. It's funny. I actually, maybe could pick your brain for a second. You said you were a monk for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So I've kind of thought about this, you know, in my awakening experience, it was like, oh, all I wanted to do was like, you go sit in the woods by myself or something, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you have this retreat where you really just like yearn for silence and everything. Right. But I couldn't do that because I had these little kids. And so it was like, I was trying to sort of work this out and work out all my internal stuff, you know, with a small child like screaming in my face, you know, it's, it was this interesting thing where I was like, trying to make my own little monastery, but as a mom or something. Yeah. And I, you know, I've never actually lived a authentic monk life or whatnot, but I was like, you know, a lot of it feels similar, just in terms of working out your junk and the routine boringness of the ordinary. You know, that was something that I really struggled with at first, was like, oh, as I'm letting go of all my drama, some of the life is really boring. You know, it's like I had to like retune my frequency to very soft, still boringness, you know, and make friends with that. And that's a lot of like what parenting is like sometimes, is like, oh, some of this is so like routine and dull. And, you know, then I have this little unregulated person who is throwing a fit or whatever. And I can feel like my like frustration rising, you know? And so honestly, like, being a parent is a spiritual practice for me.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, because there's just nothing that trips my nervous system more than having someone scream at the top of their lungs in your face.
Right, right.
So
that's where a lot of mindfulness can really come in.
Yes.
I'm going to be present to you. I'm going mm-hmm. to be, yeah, I mean, all the things. While I'm cooking, while I'm brushing my teeth, if I could be mm-hmm. present in that moment is holy.
Yes.
And what a challenge when the child's in the midst of screaming.
Yes.
Or, you know, some type of discipline or something. It's like, all right, how do I bring awareness to the holy in this?
Yes. And just trying to focus, whether that it's like having a quiet moment to yourself or just trying to focus on something and, you know, just the blatant chaotic interruption that's very jarring. I've just kind of learned to embrace all of that. And ultimately, I think in this day and age, I don't know, maybe this will be another book at some point, but how do we work this out, you know, in our day-to-day domestic life?
Right, absolutely. So, and you can say pass to this question, but your husband was very supportive when you went through all these changes you talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. Where is he at now? Has it changed his spirituality, or are you all okay operating differently?
Yeah, yes. So something that was quite interesting for me was, you know, Jared and I grew up in a very similar environment. You know, I did feel like that I had quite a bit of religious trauma, and a lot of my autonomy and agency was given over to the church and you know, pastors in the church or whatever, which were sort of this proxy for God, you know, that I felt like I had to submit to. But it was interesting because even though he was taught in the same things and grew up in the same sort of environment, it didn't seem to penetrate him in the way that it did for me. And, you know, so in that sense, I've kind of learned to make a distinction. Like, just personality types are different, you know? Mm-hmm. So he was not as absorbent as I was, which, you know, your wounds are your gifts. So even though I did feel very wounded, on the other hand, I feel like it's opened me up to what my gifts are. So, what was surprising for me was realizing how not traumatized he was by the whole thing, you know?
I'm always surprised. I'm like, how do people make it through unscathed?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that he was unscathed. I just don't feel like he had this super ego mandate where he had to like devote his whole life to the church and saving souls the way that I did. Like, I had much more of I don't know if it was a savior complex or something. I definitely felt this weight of responsibility for the people I loved and then the wider world of like, oh my God, they're going to burn in hell, you know, so we got to do something kind of thing. He wasn't losing sleep over any of that. So it was surprising to me to kind of find that out about him, and kind of a relief because, you know, I know not everyone has that in their relationships. I mean, with my whole process, I think that our relationship has gotten, I know it has gotten healthier, you know? So he had already been married to me for about a decade before all of this. So, I mean, it was an experiential difference for him, you know, like I've been married to this one woman and now she's, you know, undeniably different. You know, of course, over 5 years of that, it's been learning new rhythms and, you know, coming to different expectations of each other and all of that. But yeah, I feel very fortunate in that sense. You know, that he's, I was like, oh, he loved me for me, not because I was a Christian. And I don't know. It was kind of sad how mind blowing that was for me, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. How about we wrap up with one last part? You tell a story regarding, I believe, your daughter and mm-hmm. one of her friends talking about hell. Mm-hmm. And that story in the book actually made me cry. Mm-hmm. Do you mind sharing that?
Yeah, you're not the first person who's told me that about that story. Mm-hmm. She was about five when this awakening happened for me. And, you know, somehow we had not like really indoctrinated her with L and saying the prayer and blah, blah, blah. It was more like, you know, going to Sunday school, sing your songs and jump around. And that was kind of it. And so, you know, as I was working through all of my trauma, it was like, I don't even want her to know about this, you know, like we're not talking about this in our house. And, you know, it's about love and we love you. And, you know, that's it. So she, this was probably, I don't know, maybe she was eight or something like that. And she didn't even know what hell was. And she was on a playground with one of her friends and she came in for dinner and we could just tell that something was off with her, you know? So we're like, Nora, are you okay? Like, yeah, I'm okay. But she was just very quiet for the whole meal. And then towards the end, she was like, oh, we had noticed that she had had her hands like in fists and she wouldn't like relax her fists. And so we're like, Nora, what's going on? She said, well, my friend told me, you know, that down there is a place called hell. And if I point to it or say it, then I'm going to go there. And so
point to it or say it?
Yes.
But, wow.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's why she had her hands all bound up and
she didn't want to accidentally like this. Point.
Oh. Yeah, she didn't want to accidentally point. And so, you know, of course, we spent like an hour, you know, just talking to her, like, Nora, that's not true. But what struck me initially was how quickly she just was like, yes, this was the truth because my friend told, you know what I mean? It was like she just accepted it hook, line, and sinker. And it took a good hour for us to like unwind it, you know? And there were other like auxiliary things. There were zombies in hell and, you know, different things. Sure. So she had her own version of it. Mm-hmm. And so she was like, okay, I think I'm understanding your point, Mom and Dad, you know, that's not real. It's not something I need to worry about. And then maybe it was later that night or the next night, or I can't remember exactly, but she was like crying in bed and, you know, like, Mom, I know what we talked about, but I just feel like how could I be sure that that's not real kind of thing. It was like the fear had already made an imprint in her body that she couldn't shake. And so, you know, I kind of realized like, all right, just rationalizing this is not going to be enough for her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I scooped her up like a baby. I'm like, Nora, okay, let's just pretend like it is real. You know, let's say hell is real. Do you think that I'm going to leave you down there in a place like that? You know, I'm going to come get you. Mommy's going to come get you. And like, I'm just going to hold you until it's okay. So, you know, she's like, she's recognizing like the fear in her body. And she's like, you know, I'm pretty sure like this is hell. And I'm like, yeah, you know, like just so like perceptive for an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that was exactly my experience, just like gripped in this fear. Uh-huh. And then like, just as I held her and she, you know, was like communing with this, you know, her mother's love. She's like, oh, this is, I think it's starting to feel like heaven, you know? And so nothing about the physical environment had like changed other than it's like, yeah, you can be in darkness and in terror and this like motherly love is available to you, you know, like it's, you're like a child in a mother's womb, like it's like surrounding you. So it was like this somatic imprint of motherly love in this place called hell that she was experiencing that transformed it into heaven. So it was like, yeah, there you, it's just a matter of your perception, you know?
And I love that, you know, that even if you were in hell, do you think I would leave you there?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's God, for lack of better words. And of course, it brings that Bible verse to mind, you know, even though I make my bed in hell, you are there.
Yeah.
I'm not going to leave you there. I will come get you.
Yes.
It will be there. And to me, that's the Christ in all the ways parents do that for their children and all the ways lovers do this for their partners. I'm not going to leave you there.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Love it. Well, Heather, how do people get in touch with you and the work you're doing?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So I have a website called returningtoeden.com. You can go there. I have a monthly newsletter called Unorthodox that you can subscribe to through my website. My book is called Returning to Eden. You can get it on Amazon or whatever bookstore you like to shop at. And on Instagram, it's Heather Hamilton 1, the number 1. And on Facebook, you can search Heather Hamilton Author and find me there.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for being on here tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
This has been fantastic. If you haven't read the book, go out and get it. Just as she talked about a mother's love coming to get you, she does talk about God as mother in there and the Holy Spirit and some of the origins of that. Read the book today. Heather, have a great night.
Thanks so much.
This has been another episode of Anamkara, a friend on the journey. Thank you for walking with me. as we spent time exploring the varieties of religious and spiritual expressions out there. Won't you consider joining our Patreon? Get sneak peeks of what is to come, early previews, and soon to have some video footage from the interviews, as well as polls on what you would like to see covered in future episodes. Join our Patreon today. The link is in the show notes.